Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Latin America Review Live. And today we're with Camila in Sao Paulo. I'm in here in Bolivia and La Paz. And as well, we're joined by Eugene Pergi. So we're very happy to have all of you on. We're going to be talking about a number of different topics in the news in Latin America. But obviously, first of all, Brazil is on everyone's mind this week, and I'm sure in the weeks to come. Camila's there. How's things looking? We've seen a lot of mobilization by some Bolsonaro supporters who don't want to accept the results. Bolsonaro himself not necessarily, going all in for them. How's the situation there?
Well, that seems as if it's winding down just a bit. One of the things that, people have said is that, a lot of the Bolsonarista politicians are largely just opportunists. They're people who, now that they see that the election result is so overwhelming and clear and that it's not reversible and they're not going to be able to get their foot in for some type of coup, that they're actually just going to look to work with the incoming government of Lula da Silva. But we can talk about that a bit down the line. I would like to introduce again Eugene Puryear, who is a presenter and anchor with Breakthrough News based in New York. And he had the opportunity to come down here to Brazil during the first round to do some reporting. Eugene and the team reported both in Sao Paulo and also in Bahia. So thank you so much for joining us today, Eugene.
No, thank you so much for inviting me. Really happy to be here.
So, Camila, one thing, I've sent you the link on Twitter. Maybe we could share it to promote a bit, to let our followers know we are live. Don't know if you could send it to Eugene as well.
Did it. Okay, got it.
Sure.
Thanks so much. So we're doing this, we're actually doing this stream as a Get Casachu News to 2,000 subs episode. We haven't really done live streams. We just started doing it in La Paz right before I returned back to Brazil just about 2 weeks ago. And it's something we want to do. And I think it kind of fits, it kind of suits us because we have a very, we have a lot of limitations resource wise. And I think there's a lot of issues that we'd like to cover that we're not really able to get to. And so streaming is one way we can discuss a lot of issues in a small amount of time. And, some of the best streamers doing similar work are actually Eugene and Rania on Breakthrough News. You guys have gotten, in a small amount of time, a great viewership on YouTube. I don't know if you stream anywhere else, but really consistent with those live streams and doing that sort of news roundup covering a whole range of things, obviously far beyond what we do, which is, just a handful of countries in Latin America. So that's definitely a model for us. But so Eugene, thank you so much for being with us. So tell us a little bit. I was able to interview you while you were here in Sao Paulo, but unfortunately my mic went out. Just to tell you what happened with that, I literally, the day before the election in the first round, my mic broke. And this is like me and Ollie and others have used this mic and this cord. And so I went back to La Paz and I was able to switch it out for another one. But it was tragic because I did a great little interview with Eugene. But now he has the opportunity to tell us. So let us know what your reporting was like and what you found while you were here.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me just first say, I think anyone who's, following us, I really hope you start donating to Kawashan News. And I think anyone, watching this does the same. I think it's critically important to have a proliferation of outlets that are really about doing the right thing and bringing the struggles of people's movements to the forefront. And obviously, Camila, we were there together in the first round and I saw you hustling to get the story. So I couldn't endorse it any higher. In our coverage, which, as you mentioned, we started in Bahia, which for people who don't know is, one of the centers of Afro-Brazilian culture and the Afro-Brazilian population. It's also in the northeastern part of the country, which people probably have some sense is a very strong population or part of the country for Lula and was there. So, a lot of our reporting, which was both in Salvador, which is the largest city in Bahia, one of the largest cities in Brazil, and a very historic city in terms of Afro-Brazilian culture and struggles, and also in the what's known as the extreme south, but maybe the deep south is the better English translation of the state, which is a major rural agricultural area where the landless workers movement, the largest social movement in Latin America, has a very significant presence. So, you know, a lot of what we were there to see in that part of our trip was, you know, sort of how the Afro-Brazilian working class populations were relating to the election. And I think we saw two things. One, that Lula's presidency, candidacy was extraordinarily popular. I mean, everywhere you went in the city of Salvador, we were there maybe like we got there maybe like a week and a few days before the election. Everywhere you went, people were wearing the 13 stickers with the number, Lula, the number of the ballot where you have to do it. There were, you know, also just everything, people's cars, people's person, people wearing Lula hats, people just doing everything. I mean, it was so ubiquitous that, you know, the Workers' Party had a strong presence there and that people wanted Lula to win. You know, if you just dropped down from Mars that day, you would have known he was going to win that area for sure. And of course, he did win by about 72% of the vote. And I think what we heard from a lot of people, and this is sort of the second piece of a lot of what we saw, was that they felt that Lula's victory was, you know, bigger than just him as a person and any one person, but was the pivot point or the leverage point or the foundational move that needed to be made to make a major push, especially around issues of the working class, of anti-racist politics. And we were able to go, for example, to one of the most historic Candomblé communities in Salvador that was having a health fair one of these days, which was also sort of, you know, kind of repurposed as a political event to some degree. And, you know, that's what we were hearing from people, many of whom were a part of this effort that was called Quilombos in the Parliament, which was an effort to get more, not just Black representation into the Parliament, but a true progressive anti-racist agenda. And people were, you know, letting us know and giving us a sense that they felt Lula's victory and that Lula's campaign in and of itself was a great moment to bring in train, you know, the issues that they wanted to bring to the forefront, and that he actually spoke at the launch of this effort, the Quilombos in the Parliament effort. So, you know, sort of self-organized, but under Lula's banner and really energizing people around his personality and his policies. And I'd say the same was true when we were in the southern part of Bahia, you know, where, you know, there was a similar effort from the MST, and you covered this as well on Cowichan News with a couple interviews, probably more than a couple, of their effort to have more landless in the assemblies. And so there were a lot of candidates from the MST, 16, I think, more than they've ever had. And people were telling us, like, you know, for the popular agrarian reform, the land reform, the agroecology that'll get rid of all these chemical pesticides, that they really felt that Lula's campaign was giving them the opportunity to speak to a bigger, broader audience about the importance of these issues and to really use the campaign as an organizing tool to bring more people in the broader community into these efforts around anti-racist politics, the rights of the rural landless workers, and so on and so forth. And the final thing I'll note about that is, you know, Geronimo Rodriguez, who is the gubernatorial candidate of the Workers' Party, who did win in the second round, first ever indigenous governor in the state of Bahia. That was a big topic we talked about. It's a lot of indigenous descended people in Bahia as well, about the importance of having one of their own, essentially behind a very progressive program, you know, coming into it. So, you know, we saw quite a bit, but I think the main takeaway from, we could talk more about what we saw in Sao Paulo too, but I think the main takeaway from the whole trip, quite frankly, for me in the first round, was that, you know, there's this huge broad mass of people who really felt that Lula's election was not the answer to all their problems, and they weren't looking to him to solve all their problems. But because he's such a historic figure in the country for the gains that were made under his presidency and his history as a labor organizer, they felt that he was able to amplify these progressive agendas in a way almost nothing else could, and that they're looking forward for the days after the election to be able to build on that foundation to transform Brazil.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that people have begun to speak about in the US among sort of the anti-imperialist crowd is this sort of need to speak to the average working class person and to not speak, you know, from the university, from the academy, from elitist Marxist spaces of you know, that suggests middle class sort of Marxists who've read a lot of theory and things like that. And would you not say that this is a perfect example of that? Because we know that, like, solidly in Lula's corner during this entire campaign was the left, was the organized left, which are, you know, the strongest unions that Lula has a history, you know, of being in support of, and vice versa, is the landless workers movement, the housing movements, and those sorts of groups. But at the same time, the campaign was largely focusing on speaking to the average working class person. And we asked yesterday or 2 days ago, we spoke to one of the members of the National Directorate of the MST, Kasia Bachara. She was interviewed by Ali. And, you know, he asked what's the voter look like, you know, the average voter who supported Lula on Sunday. And she said, poor people. And that's just it. I think there's been a lot of, you know, something that I've kind of, you know, responded to on Twitter and otherwise in my own chats with friends on WhatsApp has been, you know, the sort of criticisms of Lula and his sorts of policies in the past. But at the same time, the one thing it seems that they've done really well in the Workers' Party is not trying to push a hard left agenda, but rather speaking, you know, in terms of the broadest to the broadest possible audience with issues that affect the most people.
You know, I think that's a great point. And I agree with you totally that this was a great representation of that. And you could see it. I mean, you know, obviously you can see it in the polling. I mean, the sort of the poorer you are and the less white you are, the more likely you were to support Lula. And especially if you were also a woman and under the age of 30. So, I mean, that really is his base. And that's actually the majority of the country. I mean, the majority of the country is non-white women, younger people and poorer people. And that's, you know, the last one is why a lot of people wanted to support Lula, because they don't want to be in this situation of abject poverty. And he was promising, and I think probably will deliver on this, to, you know, raise the minimum wage for instance, above the cost of inflation. And you can see for people making up to the minimum wage, up to two times the minimum wage, overwhelming support for Lula. You know, we were in Heliopolis, which is, you know, one of the larger favelas there in Sao Paulo on the election day in the first round. And, you know, for people, you know, people watching in the US or other parts like that, when you think of like the hood, this is the hood. And for sure, I mean, the people were stopping their cars and yelling to their friends, Lula, and people would see us with our camera and do the same thing. And even some people who didn't want to be interviewed were like, no, but we want you to take a photo of us throwing up the L. And it was, you know, obviously there's some people who were probably voting for Bolsonaro, some people who were just there because, you know, it's compulsory to vote. But we were talking to many, many people. Is the grassroots of the grassroots, the salt of the earth. We saw the same thing definitely in Bahia and these rural areas, these small farmers, you know, working to you know, just make a basic, decent living. Those were the people who were talking to us about how important this was. And you know, both of us, Camila, were there on the final walk of the first round in Sao Paulo. And I think one of the outstanding moments of that walk was when we went by an occupied housing where all of the women's led occupied housing of people trying to get, you know, decent living standards. And they've taken over one of these empty buildings, coming out majorly and hugely, waving the flags, saluting the walk, being very much for Lula. And I think it speaks very much to who he is. I mean, he's, and I think that's, you know, he's never held himself out to be, you know, Fidel Castro. He's never held himself out to be something that he's not. I mean, he really focuses very heavily on how to raise the floor for everyone. It's a developmentalist policy. How do you end hunger? How do you end poverty? How do you invest in healthcare and education? Now, there's more that can be done, but he is a candidate that, of course, looks at the negative ills of Brazil and wants to shrink them down significantly. And I think that speaks to a lot of people who, again, I, from the people we talked to, people were not looking for a savior. And in fact, when we were talking to folks from the popular committees and others, you know, who are organizing, you know, well over 100,000 people in, you know, 7,000 committees all across the country, unions, social movements, average everyday people, they're thinking we're going to do it for ourselves. But we have to be able to create an environment in which we can make change. And we went out to a working class metro station in Sao Paulo with the popular committees on the day before the election when they were just out leafleting at subways, as people always do during elections around the world. And I mean, not only could you see the support for Lula, but you could hear amongst people that for them, this was the campaigning in and of itself was empowering, because it was showing that like their own activity can actually change the world and change their own circumstances. And no one was giving a pitch of Lula's going to solve all their problems. It was like, this is step one to a bigger struggle to transform the country. And I think that speaks to a lot of people in Brazil, and definitely speaks to the working class, undoubtedly, which is overwhelmingly for Lula.
Yeah, I had a question. I think one of the main messages of Bolsonaro's campaign, and really every Latin American right-wing candidate movement, is if they win, if the left wins, we're going to become like Venezuela. People are going to be eating zoo animals and all these sorts of things. But like, how much does that mean in a country like Brazil, in places like where you went to, where the poverty is already there, where people face, you know, high rates of insecurity and violent crime, all the things that they're talking about, this could happen. this that's a lot of people's daily lives as well. So do you think that message was something that resonated in places like the northeast of Brazil?
You know, I think that's a great question. And it didn't seem like it really resonated. I mean, for sure, it was very active. I mean, you know, certainly people were talking to us all across Bahia about the WhatsApp networks and the fake news. And, you know, like everything was like, this is just going to be a crazy communist dictatorship like Venezuela, and they're going to make your kids gay. That was like 98% of everything that was being sent out. But when we were talking to people, people were basically saying to us that the most important things for them were the fact that hunger was increasing, the cost of living was increasing. I mean, the dire circumstances people saw during COVID, and that had really affected people. I mean, I talked to one gentleman who, you know, was not actually a Lula supporter, but he was just like, look, we've got to make a change in this country. Like the way things are going, the people who've died during COVID, the fact that people are struggling to eat, people in his own family, like things just have to change. And it reminds me a little bit, I was in Mexico right before AMLO's election and there on election day. And it was a similar form of, you know, the whole Castro Chavismo. But then when you were out in the barrios and the different parts of Mexico City, people were just like, nah, look, like this is it's not about that. And so I think in Brazil we saw, and I think we can see in the result that yes, without a doubt, some people are captured by that. But I think the point you make, Ali, is 100% correct. It rings so hollow when you're already living in poverty, when you already have seen such a decline in living standards. Like they're saying, well, there's not going to be any meat. Like there is no meat in Venezuela, which is also crazy. But I mean, you know, people are already struggling to buy meat. So what does that mean to them? That at the very least, it's a status quo. And I think also, you know, the history of the right wing in Brazil historically kind of mitigates against some of those things succeeding, because obviously the history of deep red baiting has been so significant in the country over time. I think there's a certain subset of the population that's just used to that from these individuals. And I think in a way that's partially why they leaned more on the social critique and the critique around, you know, LGBTQ rights, especially more so than they leaned on the anti-communism, although it was big, because I think they knew that it was not going to hit in the same way. And that, you know, quite frankly, people like Hugo Chavez, Fidel Castro, the country of Cuba, the history of the Cuban Revolution, there's also a lot of positive sentiment like that in many of these areas and many of these places because of their own history of having deep sort of, you know, realities of struggle and organization over the years, the Cuban doctors that had come in and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I just wanted to say if people have any questions they want to put to any of it, to either Camila that's there in Brazil, Eugene that was there, you know, or myself, you can put it in the chat. We will read it out. But yeah, you touched on the issue of like the LGBT and they're going to turn your kids gay and all this stuff. Like, did the election at certain points, and this question for both of you really, was it ever a risk of becoming like a culture war election of the sorts that we sometimes see in like Western countries where, you know, debates over these sorts of things end up dominating the whole thing. And often it's, you know, the progressive side that ends up losing out a bit when the whole debate becomes around that. Like what was Lula's response to some of this sort of a gender ideology line that Bolsonaro had?
I think it was just a lot of trying to bait the left into falling for the trap of this sort of culture war. And I think strategically, the PT knew, and this coalition of the, you know, coalition of hope is what they called it, these 10 parties that backed Lula in the race. I think they knew that they needed to just ignore it and focus on the most important issues, which are ending hunger, extreme poverty, lowering the rate of poverty, all the different things that that Eugene just explained that are extremely important to the largest section of the Brazilian population right now. If you ask me who's the most engaged in this sort of identitarian snowflake circus, it is the right. And it is the right here in Sao Paulo, the Bolsonaristas who are out there, perhaps diminished today, but who were out there for, you know, 3 days this week, blocking roads, you know, holding signs, calling for military intervention to overturn the result and refusing to concede. I mean, those people are really committed to sort of wearing the same clothes, saying the same slogans. And the thing about these Bolsonaristas is that if you go into a crowd and interview like 10, 15 people, you might not get one strong answer about why they're out there, because there's a lot of people out there, they brought their families, but they don't really know why they hate Lula. There's some people who might be able to say he's corrupt. They won't explain how he's corrupt. There are some people who just say that they don't want communism and that they don't want Brazil to be turned into Venezuela. But you're not going to get one standout person who's like on par with like a right-wing commentator on talk radio who's going to be able to very eloquently or be able to articulate why they don't like Lula. It very much to me seems like it's just that they are very much trained to be anti-Petista against PT, who left them and understand. And there was even a viral video going around today. I'm not sure which day it was recorded or the location, but someone was asked, why they're out there. And they said they don't like the state of the country. This is a Bolsonaro supporter saying they don't like the way things are and they want things to be better. But Bolsonaro has been in the presidency for 4 years. So they're complaining about this.
Well, he still is the president.
He still is the president for another 2 months. And so they're complaining about their own president. He's saying things need to change. I don't like the way things are. Things need to change. And that was my experience. I was too afraid to pull out my microphone and have more people ask me, you know, what media outlet I'm from, what country I'm from. So I just spoke to people. But they couldn't give me a good answer. But it was the opposite when I was at the not the pro-Lula rallies around here in Sao Paulo. For example, the day before the election, they did another caminata, another parade through the streets of Sao Paulo. And I was actually just asking people the same questions, like, you know, what do you think? These are the final hours. Why is it so important to campaign until victory? And people were giving me the most articulate answers because, I mean, it seems like everyone knows exactly why they want Lula back, exactly why they, you know, what they want to see in terms of economic prosperity for the country, in terms of restoring democracy and restoring faith in the country's institutions. And people were saying this far better than I could ever say it. And so they know why they're voting for this candidate. And there's not really anyone concerned about these totally fake claims about unisex bathrooms or anything else. It's not even come up in conversations in any of the interviews I've done with Lula supporters. And truly, and I've said this before, people are really not focused on the issue specifically in this election of LGBTQ rights or specifically in ways that they haven't been for years. Obviously, a lot of people are activists and they mobilize and organize around these issues because they're very important and they affect people on an ongoing and permanent basis. But this election was simply not about that. It was more about restoring dignity and economic rights on the most basic level, largely having to do with employment, salaries, dignified wages. Those are the issues that people are talking about.
Yeah, we actually get a question. Lisa Mojica said she saw interviews of Bolsonaristas on Al Jazeera and they all say they don't like Lula because he was in prison. Do they not know the whole story? And of course, if they say they don't like him because he's in prison, it begs the question of why do they think he's not there anymore? And I don't know, like, what, like, was, did that come up a lot on in the campaign? Well, to people you spoke to, Eugene, especially, you know, even people who support him, was that seen, is that something that's like in considered in the past now or part of his appeal as someone because he was persecuted against, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I think from the people I talked to, it was really a part of his appeal. And I think a lot of people felt that he had been wronged. You know, the impact of these various lawfares, the so-called car wash investigation had been, you know, just another example of the elite of Brazil trying to put their thumb on the scale of a, you know, at least nominally democratic process in order to get what they want. And I think for, you know, many people that the way Lula was, you know, he didn't flee the country. He didn't go somewhere. You know, he didn't try to, you know, just plead his innocence, you know, in some, you know, way where he would never be held accountable. But he took on the legal process head on. He went through all of the different hoops and all of the different hearings and all of the different elements that were put in front of him, and he was able to succeed. And I think that that in and of itself really sort of belied this whole issue of Lula being corrupt. And I think in a way it kind of backfired on them because Lula was saying, okay, if I'm corrupt, then prove it. Take me to court. I'll go to jail. Prove it with your facts. And when they went to court, they could not prove it with the facts. And I think that in and of itself played a big role in diffusing that line of argument amongst a broader subset of the population, maybe not amongst some Bolsonaristas, but I think amongst a lot of people, because it's like, well, look, this has already actually been hashed out. We actually have seen the evidence. We saw that he didn't did not do it. And then we saw that the guy who persecuted him then had everything, you know, overturned in the context of it. And I do think that there was an element of reality that was able to break through, which certainly speaks to the integrity of Lula's legal strategy. And I think that, you know, the sort of inclusiveness of the campaign of bringing in so many different elements, you know, to speak back to the last point as well, is really important. I mean, you know, I think, you know, people were pivoting, you know, not really pandering, if you will, on some of these social issues that were being demagogued on Bolsonaro and turning it around on people. Well, he's saying XYZ about Lula, but as Camila was saying, can you eat? Can you afford? Can you work? Do you have a job? So like, really, realistically, why are you that concerned about that? But also in the broader Brazil of Hope umbrella, it was like all different types of people, and a big subset of the LGBTQ community was really surprised. I mean, most of them supporting Lula, you know, Erica Hilton, who made history as the first trans person to go in as a federal deputy. You know, she was going super hard in the second round and making all these points about hunger, about joblessness, and about how she comes from a historically marginalized community as well, and that this deeply affects them. And we had the opportunity to talk to many people who felt the same way. So I feel that, you know, by making the issues very clear that Lula was looking to address, combating the fake news around some of the stuff that was ridiculous, like the unisex path, things he's just never said, but also in the context of the campaign being very inclusive. So when you look at the campaign of Brazil of Hope, you saw everybody in terms of the cross-section of Brazilians. When you look at the Bolsonaro campaign, you saw a very narrow subset of the country of Brazil. And I think people seeing that, it sends a message about, you know, who's really for what and what this thing is really about.
Eugene, I just wanted to ask, like, you know, you're American, and like, how would you compare Bolsonaro supporters and Trump supporters? Because when I see some of the videos that Camila's been posting about, you know, of these Bolsonaro supporters that mobilize, they actually seem a little bit less mixed in terms of like class and things than some like Trump rallies that you see. So I don't know how you'd say that.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I would say ideologically very similar. I think they're motivated by similar things. I think that it's a similar kind of like lower middle class grievance politics that motivates both Trump and Bolsonaro. I it's tough to say. I mean, it depends on the Trump rally in terms of how different they look. But I do think that, you know, they're both deeply rooted in a very similar sort of, you know, feeling that the negative slides or the things they've seen in society that they don't like is somehow responsible for the lack of homogeneity in the country, essentially. And they're motivated by all these various things, whether they be, they're more, I think Camila's right about that. They're more motivated by the identitarian, the religious appeals, the racial appeals for sure, which are very significant and definitely not, cannot be underplayed in the context of Brazilian politics. But I actually viewed them as pretty similar in sort of seeing them, not only the crowds, but just interacting and seeing the people themselves. Like in a country, in a state like Bahia, you know, it's a heavy Afro-Brazilian state. It actually reminded me a lot of like being in the Deep South, states like Alabama, like Mississippi, you know, in terms of like who's supporting Trump and who's, you know, not, and how that really plays down on class and on racial lines. And I think when you look at the polling, you see similar things. Now, what I will say is I think Trump has probably been more effective than Bolsonaro at reaching a subset of the working class. I think some of that is also because the stratification of the working class in America is more intense than Brazil. Like Brazil is much more traditionally Latin American, and like a big chunk of people who are living in poverty, and a much more significant middle class population. Where the US, we also have that sort of higher level of workers and people who may not really be like middle class per se, but have similar grievances in terms of how things have played out for them. So you do see, I think, a little bit more of that cross section in Trump, but I do think that there's a very similar core to what kind of motivates them and why these right-wing politics are able to capture them and mobilize them.
What do you think, Camila? Because like a lot of the videos that you've sent, they seem like everyone's white at these Bolsonaro rallies, which, you know, if everyone's white at a Trump rally, it's like, okay, you expect that. But Brazil is a more diverse country that still even more so than the United States. So I think surely that's more significant that they're all white.
Well, we are in Sao Paulo, which is quite white. I'm sure it's a little bit different in other parts of the country. I did feel like it was something, I think it was very different, distinct from the U.S. because I, of course, grew up in Arizona. And I know like the towns of Arizona that are all largely white. And I just really feel like that they were more successful, as Eugene suggested, you know, that sort of not just Trump, but, you know, sort of the Republicans in general in the U.S. have been a bit more successful in recent years, maybe the last decade, and getting, you know, more Latinos, more Black African descendant people on their side, appealing to all these different groups than here. I think here, there, you know, almost half of the country did vote for Bolsonaro, but I would not say that these people who voted for Bolsonaro are prepared to go out and fight for this election the way, you know, the extremists have been doing out there. I think that, you know, these people are largely being, you know, brainwashed and herded into doing this. They're doing the work of, you know, agribusiness or whoever it is really, you know, really behind the efforts to prevent Lula from taking office in January. And, you know, the sorts of things they say are saying are very extreme. I mean, nobody who wants to be taken seriously in this sort of electoral competition would come out with placards and signs saying military intervention now. I mean, this is obviously, it is coordinated. It's being coordinated through WhatsApp chats, Telegrams, chats as well. And, but it's not really attributed to any organization, any political party. These are protests outside that are not being led by any Bolsonaro politician. So in large part, you're seeing tons of supporters, but you're not seeing, you know, individuals who are the face of this sort of uprising against the election result. I think because nobody really wants to be associated with it, even though they're so large. I do believe it is just a bunch of people who are, you know, angry. The way I described it to Ollie when I went out there, it was a little bit intimidating because they hate journalists. They don't care if you're a right-wing journalist right now, or if you're from like one of the big outlets that has traditionally supported Bolsonaro and been shitting on Lula, they absolutely hate the media. So, I mean, I'm no different. The only thing that protects me is that maybe they like foreign journalists, but they, you know, absolutely didn't want to do any interviews or anything like that. But, you know, they were, you know, they're saying the same extremist slogans over and over about Venezuela, about, you know, being anti-communist. I'm not really sure how long that lasts, but what I described to, you know, to Ollie was that it was very tense and that it seemed like it was like the documentary on Netflix about Woodstock 99 when Fred Durst and Limp Bizkit came on stage and then everybody literally started to break stuff. Like they literally started tearing apart like the stage and the sound tower. And it was just a lot of people with pent up energy wanting to take it out on something with no real direction of where to go. And then they also have pyrotechnics and then they're also lighting things on fire and yelling. And I mean, I'm not sure how far that will go.
Yeah, well, we've got a question in the chat from Ervco saying, I've seen Brazilians say that society is much more divided by class rather than race and that race wasn't much of a topic in the election apart from maybe indigenous issues. Is this true? So I don't know, Eugene, you know, especially talking to Afro-Brazilian voters, it, you know, what was that the was issue of, you know, racism the reason that they were, you know, in large numbers supporting Lula, or was that not something they necessarily talked about?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think the answer is yes, it was. And I think that people see race and class as coming together really as sort of one issue. You know, rightfully so, that, you know, sort of the fact that the Northeast in and of itself and Bahia, where we are, like, why are the sort of most Black and indigenous areas of the country also the poorest and most working class areas of the country, you know, proportionally, obviously speaks to the fact that sort of the racial stratifications were introduced to push a very specific form of capitalist accumulation, if I can be a little Marxist about it. And, you know, I think that what we were hearing, especially from Afro-Brazilian people, was sort of that the issue of representation was not purely about representation, but about an agenda that would address these deep inequalities. Like, from the way I was hearing it articulated by many people was that it was almost like a two-step process, right? That on the one hand, they needed to have someone like Lula in there, because Lula was the person who was going to build the foundation to at least start addressing, in the most general sense, all of the problems that are disproportionately affected by Afro-Brazilians. And then on top of that, they were building this broader anti-racist platform, so that once Lula was elected and once, you know, new people were elected at the gubernatorial level and a larger number elected at the congressional level and at the state legislative level, that they could then start to bring in an agenda that was targeted not just at the general level of class inequalities, but also targeting the specific realities of where Indigenous people and Afro-Brazilians are disproportionately suffering from some of the same pieces. And I think that's why they were able to build such a broad, inclusive campaign, because it was like, okay, let's raise the floor and the foundation for every single person. And let's also address at the same time, as we continue to build this new transformative house in Brazil, the reason why some people were on the first floor and some people were in the basement. And that if we can sort of bring these two things in together, we can really make big changes. And I think Lula himself, you know, made himself a focal point in that way for these agendas. I mean, like I said, he was there at the kickoff of the quilombos in the parliament effort. He was there with the indigenous communities multiple times when they were, because they had a similar platform amongst the indigenous communities as well to get more indigenous representation as they did. He was there, he was representing that, and he was speaking to that. So he made himself almost like an umbrella under which individuals who felt they would generally benefit from the Lula agenda could be a part of it, but that also he wanted to be welcome to the idea that there were specific agendas, many of which he was in solidarity with, that also needed to be pushed if we're talking about transforming Brazil. And I thought it was a very creative way of sort of uniting kind of a minimum program and a slightly higher program of what people wanted to see. And I think this is why he won, because he was able to speak in a way that was both broad and specific while not being exclusive of anyone. But definitely in Bahia, I can say, which is very, very, very heavily Black. I mean, you know, 56% of the country self-identifies as Black and brown in Brazil. There, it's even higher. Like, you know, because of the strength of the anti-racist movement there, almost every ad you see in Bahia is Black and indigenous people now. And there are many fewer white people, which is not the same case in Sao Paulo. So you can see the impact of the racial politics and the racial polarization. And the final little anecdote I'll give you on that, in that gubernatorial election, the guy running against Geronimo Rodriguez, the Lula-supporting PT candidate, was this guy, ACM Neto, from a very right-wing party, YouNow. And ACM Neto is definitely white. But because the discourse around race in Bahia was very strong and the need to have, you know, more representation amongst Black people, he actually said, "I am a Black person." And it became a major part of the gubernatorial election, is like him trying to say, like, "I actually am Black and Geronimo is not Black. So if you want to support Black people in Bahia, you have to vote for me." Now, ultimately, that totally backfired on him. Geronimo Rodriguez is indigenous, dark-skinned indigenous guy. He got a lot of support. He even got support from Bolsonaro supporters. There was something called a Geronimonaro or something, if you say it right, supporter of people who were supporting him and Bolsonaro. So it didn't work, but it does give you a sense of how it was playing, that this guy ACM Neto, whose family is a white family from the settler colonial 1600s era, was trying to claim to be Black in order to hopefully get some clout in the election in the state.
Quite a reification of race, really, isn't it? As they say.
Ollie, unless there are more any questions in the chat.
I wanted to
ask Eugene one last thing, but he might have to skedaddle soon. I'm not sure. I know he has a busy day, as always.
Last question. Throw it in. I'm ready.
Well, do you have another question, Ollie? Because I wanted to ask him something.
I'll just read out some of the messages, not necessarily questions, but AG sure. Says, thanks for the coverage. Hit like, yes, and hit subscribe and hit share, all of that. Big Teal says, you, peace Eugene, and a fire emoji. So that's a Eugene fan right there. He's put another few messages sort of in that vein. Big Teal also says, peace Camilla. Hope she gets to come on by any means necessary. Someone else, Emma aka Volvo, saying peace Big Teal. So that's a Eugene and Camilla fans right there.
Fabulous. Go ahead, Camilla. Well, as Eugene well knows, and everyone at Breakthrough News knows, yesterday the world made a resounding vote once again at the UN General Assembly in 185 countries, which is up from last year, 184, voted on a draft resolution to end the U.S. genocidal illegal blockade on Cuba. And this is something that news that Breakthrough News brought us. And I do believe that, you know, maybe because of the proximity to the Cuban embassy and, you know, everything there in New York with the General Assembly or with the Cuban mission to UN, let's say, that you guys have been doing a lot around that, as well as the People's Forum has been a venue where a lot of important events have taken place in order to kind of bridge people's, you know, in the U.S. to Cuban peoples and sort of campaign about this issue of ending the 60-year blockade on Cuba. What was your reaction to that? And tell us, you know, like, you know, undoubtedly, and I think this was said in many of the speeches that we heard on the at the General Assembly podium, was that by maintaining this blockade on Cuba, the United States is not only, you know, ignoring and defying the rest of the world and the will of the Cuban people, but actually the will of a growing number of people in the United States as well.
You know, I think that is 100% true. I mean, I think we've seen whatever negative things we can say about Barack Obama. I think the very fact that he eased relations with Cuba and there was no negative implication from an electoral standpoint shows that so many people in the U.S. are ready to see a change in contact in relationship to the rest of the world. And I would say yesterday's vote was really notable because some of the countries, obviously like Colombia, have had huge changes, and that's why they voted against the blockade. But you see some of the countries like, you know, Fiji and these small Pacific islands that the U.S. is always, you know, they're usually able to strong arm one or two of them to voting in favor of the blockade for obvious reasons. That did not happen this year. And I think that speaks very heavily to another big controversy, which is the role of China in the world. But I think the very fact that these small Pacific islands are able to now balance between the U.S., between Australia, between Japan, between China, and all these different countries for their own mutual benefit makes them feel that they have more freedom to be able to speak out and speak their mind in the way they really want to. And they, like 185 others, or joined 185 others, to speak against this ridiculous blockade. And I think that really it speaks to the fact that not only is the Cuban blockade so unjust, and people can see that, but it speaks to this the unbelievable lawlessness of the United States, where they can just decide to blockade a country and force every other country to abide by their rules when no one has any other input. I mean, it also speaks to how broken the UN system is, that the vast majority of UN members are in fact against this, and yet and still it remains in place. But I do think it was very hopeful because it speaks to the changes we're seeing in Latin America. I'm hoping next year, I feel very confident we're going to get Brazil on there. And then, no, it's going to be basically be the U.S. and Israel, and I guess the people who forget to show up, who are going to be, you know, against it or whatever it may be. But I do think the rise of a multipolar world, the erosion of U.S. unipolar hegemony, was very, very much on the agenda. So, you know, I'll say that, and I'll leave it there. And I just want to really stress to people one more time, please make a financial contribution to Cowichan News. The team there is working very hard. We need many, many more voices who are out there. So if you're watching, please do something, support, help, you know, share if you can't help, but please, if you can, make a contribution.
Eugene, I want to ask one quick one before you leave. How did you like Brazilian food while you're there?
Amazing. I'm still thinking about some of the meals that I had in Brazil. Let me tell you, when we were in the countryside with the MSC folks, ooh, they were like hooking it up for us in ways that I'm dreaming about still. So shout out to everybody who cooked for us and fed us, because man, whoo, it was good. And that cachaça, that liquor they have down there is no joke either.
Caipirinhas.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Eugene.
Right on. Thank you guys, and appreciate you for all your work.